the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Governor Gavin Newsom's homelessness task force had its first public meeting. Find out how quickly action will follow all that talking. Plus, what if we change the name of the show to appeal to Spanish speakers? Instead of Take Two, will Google translate our name to Tomar Dos? No, we're not doing that. But political candidates try to sprinkle a little Spanish in their messages all the time. Smart move or just hispandering? It's ahead on Tomar Dos. I mean, Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Hope your week's getting off to a great start. Thanks, as always, for joining us. Coming up later on today's show, we recap what happened at the California GOP convention over the weekend. That's coming up in about 15 minutes. Plus, we speak with a researcher whose work may alter the timeline for the state's indigenous peoples. More on that in about half an hour. But we start today with the homeless crisis, because last Friday was the very first public meeting of Governor Gavin Newsom's Task Force on Homelessness. Its members are a collection of local politicians and experts in the field, and their goal is to address a problem that isn't only in Southern California, but really all over the state. We welcome now L.A. County Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas, who's also the co-chair of the task force. He's here to tell us about its first steps. Supervisor Thomas, thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be here, and thank you.
Now, this first meeting was in Modesto, where you heard from locals about the homeless problem there. What were some of the things you learned that show how homelessness has really boomed in Southern California?
In Modesto, we learned quite a bit about their innovation, about the intensity of their work. One of the interesting things that they did was to look at the parks in Modesto that were being occupied by quite a number of homeless individuals. And it was driving down the quality of life of those who were engaged in recreation in the parks.
Yeah.
So they designated a single park where they set up a FEMA-like, Red Cross-like program that has been quite successful, transitioning them from homelessness.
How did what you see up there compare to what's going on here?
I think it sets a nice example for what we could do here in Los Angeles. In other words, they were able to identify approximately 3+ acres adjacent to a freeway. They set up temporary structures with washroom facilities. They put services in there, but they got them off the streets into a safe environment where they could transition them into housing.
So, Supervisor, is this the primary mode you're in right now, just fact-finding and listening sessions?
Yes. The governor has asked that we fact-find, we listen, we learn, and then we lead. This is going to lend itself to action.
But these are, when you say it's going to lead to action, can you understand how frustrated people would be hearing you say that? Because if this is all that's going to happen right now, how quickly will this lead to action? Shouldn't this be sped up a lot faster?
Well, the point to be made is to create an environment in which people really understand what is happening. That's why I say this is the time for the declaration of a state of emergency, so you can bring in tools and resources that otherwise would not be the case. For me, that is the ultimate play in terms of action, to put a fine point on the urgency of the item, and that is what's currently being negotiated.
Now, Supervisor, you're calling for an emergency declaration of homelessness in the state. What does that mean, and why ask for it?
What that means is regulations would be relaxed, some of which would mean CEQA, or regulations that would be relaxed for the purpose of us being able to build faster and the like. It would mean that we would unleash resources in terms of public health and mental health that are not currently available. Then it further means that we would have to have an allocation of substantial resources to get more done than what has currently been done.
And is that on the governor to just simply declare it?
It is a question of the governor's executive action and in tandem with the legislature.
Why wouldn't he do it? Why wouldn't the legislature do it? We hear lawmakers in the state all the time talk about how action is needed. It's a crisis. We need something to happen. So if they can do it, it's in their hands. Why don't they?
It's not a question of the governor not doing it. It's a question of how to do it, how to sustain it in terms of the resources that it requires. And I do believe that the governor This governor has more receptivity and openness to this conversation than previous administrations.
So Governor Jerry Brown has to shoulder some of the blame for what we're seeing today on the streets?
There's no two questions about that. The issue of homelessness was not a priority for the Brown administration, one. And secondly, the dissolution of redevelopment contributed to taking offline a building, at least a 20% set aside of affordable housing. Affordable housing is in part the key to the crisis. And if you take the resources away from the public and private sector to build affordable housing, you've essentially done a lot of damage and expanded the homelessness index.
We're talking to L.A. County Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas. Just a few weeks ago, the governor abandoned his campaign to promise to create California's first homelessness czar, relying on your task force and his own staff. Does that leave this effort without a clear leader to coordinate it?
No, I don't believe so, because this is a very complicated issue. It's a very heavy lift. And so I think the governor putting together a panel from across the state of elected leaders, business sector leaders, persons who have had extensive experience in the public sector, means that we're going to have a much more robust look at this issue and create a path forward that I think will be precedent-setting.
Now, recently we talked with L.A. City Controller Ron Galperin, who issued a report critical of L.A. Homeless Services Authority and how it had been handling some of its efforts in the city. It found that L.A. was falling far behind the benchmarks the organization had set to help people. Is there enough accountability up and down the chain so we know that when people just like you, Supervisor Thomas, say that they're addressing the problem, that there's actually proof?
Yes. Measure H required accountability as an oversight entity is in place. And so what we have is at any point in time, an opportunity for individuals to go to websites that give all of the information that they need. And there are four of them. The county has one. The city has one. The Everyone In campaign has one. And LASA itself has one. In addition to that, there's a joint task force between academics from USC and UCLA working on this issue with a lot of intensity.
So, Supervisor, what do you say to someone out there who is angry and frustrated and is thinking, at best, when it comes to homelessness, we're treading water? At worst, it's getting so bad that we can't do much about it.
That is an understandable sentiment, but I can sure assure you that a ton of work is going on, and we just have to do the work better with more intensity. But you cannot snap your finger and think this is going to resolve itself. It's been neglected for an incredible period of time. I'm going to meetings practically every day in the public and private sector where there's much more focus on this, and that's a good sign. Everybody knows that they have a stake in this. Otherwise, matters worsen.
Now, the next meeting for the governor's task force on homelessness will be in Los Angeles in a few weeks. When and where is it so that our listeners can attend?
We expect it to be on September the 27th. That's Friday, September 27th, on the campus of Martin Luther King Health Campus.
And what sorts of comments and stories matter to you the most when this meeting happens?
Well, I think they can come forward with specific concerns that they may have, and we'll be equipped to answer those questions, make referrals, and the like. But the point of the task force is to look at what's going on throughout the state of California, ultimately make recommendations to the governor. And if I can just be very blunt with you, had the previous administration put more emphasis and focus on the issue that we are facing now, I suspect that it wouldn't be as challenging as we are currently finding it in the state of California.
LA County Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas, who's also co-chair of Governor Gavin Newsom's Task Force on Homelessness. Supervisor, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A. Martinez.
Moving on, Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, Airbnb, they're among the biggest names in the gig economy and all California originals. These on-demand services depend on people who are willing to work a gig, be it host, driver, or courier. But it turns out that business backbone runs contrary to state law. As part of our California Dream collaboration, Capital Public Radio's Randall White explains the industry disruption that may lie ahead.
About a mile from the terminals at Sacramento International Airport is a waiting zone. It's the cell phone lot where dozens of Uber and Lyft drivers wait their turn to get a passenger request.
I am 1 to 5, which means I'd say in about 15 minutes I'll be getting a ride.
Sandy Miner is 45 minutes into her wait, checking the incoming flight list against her position in the queue. A bit more time and her ride is there.
Hey, Jeff.
Two cars over is Jeff Perry. He's a half hour in and still has about 50 drivers in front of him.
Sometimes it's quick, sometimes we're right now. This happens to be a busy time of night, right? A lot of flights are coming in between 8 and 10.
Both Perry and Miner work as independent contractors for both rideshare companies. This means they can work wherever and whenever they want. But it also means they don't receive any of the benefits like vacation time, overtime, and medical coverage that state law mandates for a worker who is considered an employee. The rideshare companies maintain the majority of their workers have full-time jobs elsewhere where they get their benefits and prefer the flexibility for making an extra buck. But Perry sees it differently.
Like, I don't deserve a fair wage because another guy pays me a fair wage, and then in my time off, you should be able to cheat me or something? I don't understand that.
A recent California Supreme Court decision called Dynamics sides with Perry, saying these drivers are employees based on a three-part ABC test, with B being the big one.
That's exactly right. I mean, the B is the one that's giving everyone consternation.
Los Angeles attorney Timothy Kim works for a firm that represents gig economy companies. He says the B test requires the person's work to be outside the normal business activities of the hiring company. For example, if a pizza shop hires somebody to clean the windows, that person could be an independent contractor. But if it hires someone to make pizzas, that person would have to be an employee. Businesses throughout California, not just the gig economy players, will be affected in some way by this test.
Because almost every large company uses independent contractors to some extent.
And now, Assembly Bill 5, a bill written by Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez, hopes to take that test and bake it into California law. She says this will level the playing field.
A lot of people are getting rich, and it's not the workers, and it's at the cost of the taxpayers.
AB 5 limits who will be affected by carving out professions that can remain as independent contractors, including emergency room doctors, realtors, and insurance brokers. Other exemptions are still being decided, but it's unlikely the gig companies will be among them. Instead, Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash are lobbying for a new category of worker that falls between contractor and employee, possibly bringing that issue to voters at the ballot box.
All eyes are on California right now to see how this shakes itself out.
Jarrett Dieterle works for a libertarian think tank in Washington, D.C. He says a compromise to include this new worker category could set California apart as a nationwide model. But as currently written, Dieterle says AB 5 could cost the business sector as much as $6 billion annually.
And so if a broad swath of California's workforce was moved over to become employees instead of contractors, it would have a lot of costs.
Back to Jeff Perry, the Uber driver at Sacramento International. About 2.5 hours after first arriving at the lot, he's dropping off his passenger and got word from the company about his earnings for the ride. $12.14.
I can't just sign on for an hour and go make money. This is not possible. Any driver who's been doing this for a while knows that.
Randall White, Cap Radio News.
The California GOP was live and direct from the IE this past weekend for their annual convention. Republican Party has had a tough time holding on to local and statewide seats for some time now, but it really came to a head in 2018 when U.S. congressional seats flipped from red to blue. Coming up here, what game plans emerged and why some feel the Trump family could be just beginning a Kennedy-esque type political run. That's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. California Republicans converged on an Indian Wells resort for their annual convention this past weekend. Billed as a training event, attendees could choose from a variety of speaker sessions with names such as Surviving on Liberal College Campuses and Engaging Hispanic Communities. Attendees also heard from surrogates for President Trump, including campaign manager Brad Pascal. Politico's Carla Marinucci was there, and she's joining us now. Hello, Carla.
Hey, A, good to be with you.
How are you holding up after a weekend at Indian Wells? It's not bad.
I survived the 110-degree weather. That's
yeah, that was it was tough. That part was tough. Okay, we talked to you on Friday ahead of the convention, and you were there to see it all go down. First off, how would you describe the mood over the weekend?
Well, you know, the California Republican Party has been down in the dumps. They've been dogged by a lot of internal fighting, morale problems. I mean, this is a party that's in third-party status here in California. But boy, I got this up-close and personal look at the hardcore activists. And has there been a switch? These guys were upbeat. They seemed energized. They were, you know, grabbing up those Trumpifornia T-shirts. And it looked like a real turnaround. They saw this event as a reboot of the party. They think they have the stuff in 2020 to take back some of those seven House seats that flipped last time around. And a lot of the folks who weren't with Trump in the last two cycles, they look to be completely on board.
Now, that mood is significant, right? Because I'm wondering how it contrasted maybe with the Democratic convention earlier this summer.
Yeah, it was a big contrast because just a few weeks ago, we covered that Democratic National Committee meeting in San Francisco. Yeah. And there you saw the Democrats talking about circular firing squad, debating, protesting, fighting each other. You know, at one point, they debated for 2 hours whether or not to have a televised climate change debate for their presidential candidates. And they've got, of course, these primary battles going on, and that's pitted the candidates and the camps against each other. So that is just part of the stuff that has the Republicans fired up. They feel that they're unified on their end, and they also, many of them feel that the Democratic presidential candidates are going so far to the left that it's going to give them a shot with voters in 2020.
It's almost like California's red, not blue, right? If you contrast both.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it, this is still an overwhelmingly Democratic state, you know, but the fact is, they think that this time around, they've got the message and they've got some candidates, particularly Asian American women and minority candidates, that are going to help them make some gains in California.
So what kind of ideas were floated to overcome these hurdles that you mentioned? I mean, Republicans lost seven House seats last year.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, look, the new state party chair, Jessica Milan Patterson, who herself is a Latina mother of two, said that, you know, they've got new moves. They've got new messaging. They've got whole new digital directives. She says the party has already attracted something like 7,000 new donors, including 72 major donors. That's a very big deal. That's helped them collect $5 million. That's a 20% increase this year. She said they have got 20,000 new volunteers on board in the last month. I have to say, a lot of those folks, those volunteers, were at Indian Wells. They were learning how to rev up the voters, and they were learning all kinds of new digital stuff, including with the, you know, ballot harvesting, the kind of things that that made the Democrats gave them an edge in 2018.
California is a cash register, isn't it, Carla? I mean, doesn't matter what party it does. You can just show up and get some money and just punch in your numbers and get something out of the machine.
Well, that's right. I mean, and look, President Trump's coming here next week. He's going to Silicon Valley. He's going to Bel Air. He's going to San Diego. And we heard that all three of those are probably sold out or close to sold out already.
Talking to Politico's Carla Marinucci, who was at the California GOP convention in Indian Wells over the weekend. I mentioned some of those sessions, 35 sessions in all. What ideas were explored in these sessions that people could sign up for?
It's the kind of stuff that they're going to need if they have to turn this party around, engaging Hispanic communities, reaching out to the Asian American vote. There were at least 5 Trump Victory Leadership Initiative classes. These were kind of secret classes. We were not allowed to sit in on these, by the way, that were designed to teach field organizing and volunteer recruitment, introducing new tools for voter registration. There was a lot of emphasis on having individual folks follow up with voters, try to contact at least 12 voters each. And you know, these sessions, I have to say, were packed to the rafters with Republican volunteers and activists. So the party is pretty buoyed by, you know, what they're seeing here.
Now, among the attendees was kind of a who's who of key GOPers. I want to focus on a few of them. One, Assemblyman Chad Mays. He's talked on this show about the toxic effects Trump has had on California in the past, in his opinion. What did he say, and how was Chad Mays received there?
Yeah, remember, Chad Mays has kind of been a bad guy to a lot of the Republicans, the hard right Republicans. He and former Governor Schwarzenegger founded that group called New Way California to moderate the party. He introduced a plank in the party's platform formally stating the Republican Party's objection to intolerance and racism. And that move was seen by some of the hardcore activists as a shot against President Trump. One of the Tea Party activists there has called it, you know, as popular as a stink bomb in an elevator. But in the end, it passed. The party didn't want to stand against intolerance and racism, I guess. But Mays wasn't alone in the fact that many Republicans were saying, look, the party of the GOP has become the party of Trump, and they're concerned about that. Remember, this is a state that's home to the largest number of immigrants, fast-growing Latino population, and they've got to deal with that. But the fact is, look, Chad Mays got his move passed, and that was a big win for him.
Now, one more person to note was Trump campaign manager Brad Pascal, who made what some consider an eyebrow-raising statement during his keynote. Tell us what he said.
That's right. He said this is going to induce Democrats to reach for the Tylenol, but the Trumps will be a dynasty that will last for decades. He not only said that President Trump is going to handily win in 2020, but he talked about the children of Trump. We asked him about that. He mentioned Don Jr. He mentioned Ivanka. He mentioned Jared. He said you can see from all of them that it is going to be a dynasty. So Democrats, take note.
And well, it makes sense, right, to sow those seeds now before you get closer.
Yeah, that's
to,
it. Yeah. But I have to say, we asked him if President Trump coming here next week is actually going to be appearing with any of these candidates, standing next to them and campaigning. Brad Pascal would not answer that question.
All right. Carla Marinucci, senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Carla, thanks a lot.
Always good to be with you. Thanks.
All right, to personal economics now. California companies pioneered the online gig economy, and the state has a higher share of people working on platforms such as Uber and Lyft. For some, it's a full-time job. Others just want to earn a little extra cash. But some economists say the gig economy is also filling gaps in our social safety net. It's something workers can fall back on when other jobs don't provide enough to live here. As part of our statewide California Dream collaboration, KPCC's David Wagner reports.
As an up-and-coming comedian in L.A., Madison Shepard does stand-up a few nights a week.
Please welcome Madison Shepard.
Woo!
Tonight, she's performing in a romantic bookstore.
I am going through a breakup, which is really hard. My ex, he blocked me on all social media, which is like, okay, but how can I ask him to move out of my apartment? You know, like, how do I contact him?
Making people laugh is Shepherd's passion, but for now, it doesn't pay her bills. She can afford to pursue this.
But anyways, my name is Madison Shepard. Good night!
By doing this.
Right now, we just turn on the app. It says we're online.
Driving for Lyft keeps her afloat and provides space for creativity.
Driving gives me a lot of time to think about my jokes, think about joke order, what I want to say.
Shepard used to work more traditional 9-to-5s, but they never gave her the flexibility she needed, the option to drop everything for an audition or a video shoot.
Imagine if I went to my employer, I was like, hi, I know I asked for Thursday off, but my shoot got rescheduled. Oh, and by the way, Monday I need to leave early, about 3 hours, so I can drive down to San Diego. So I'll see you, I guess, sometime Tuesday at 10 or 11? Like, there's no way I'm going to be able to keep my job doing that.
Aspiring actors can drive for Uber and Lyft while they wait for their big break. Other kinds of workers depend on these platforms for survival. They drive when they're between jobs, when their freelance projects dry up, or when they lose hours at their main job. In a 2018 survey, 38% of California gig workers said they or someone in their household either lost a job or had their hours cut in the previous year, and nearly half struggled with poverty.
The typical household deals with a lot of income volatility from month to month.
Dimitri Kustis at the University of Chicago has seen people in these situations turning to gig platforms. For a recent study, he got access to data from an online personal financial services company. And he saw a common story in that data. People's income would go down, and they would respond by dipping into their savings, racking up credit card debt, until eventually they would start driving for Uber or Lyft.
They become better able to deal with these periods of income volatility.
Kustis found that driving replaced 73% of their lost income on average. Stanford economist Paul Oyer says evidence like this points to the emergence of the gig economy as an alternative safety net.
Our safety net for people who don't have jobs is not generally as generous as in some other Western countries.
People have to find some way to make ends meet. For many, getting on Uber or Lyft may be the easiest option.
The barriers to entry are so low. It's really unprecedented.
Of course, driving has its problems. Drivers lack many benefits. And after recent pay cuts from Uber and Lyft, California drivers can earn less than the state's minimum wage. But Oyer says a lot of people might not be able to get by without this safety net.
There's not a lot out there that's as quick and easy for bringing some of your earnings back.
But Oyer says its future is unclear. The California state legislature is considering a bill that would push companies like Uber and Lyft to reclassify their workers as employees rather than independent contractors. Under an employee model, it could become harder to start driving or to pick it up and put it down whenever you want.
If Uber and Lyft have to reclassify these jobs, all bets are off.
Whatever happens in Sacramento, economists say this safety net has other limitations. It may help individuals get through a rough patch, but it probably won't hold up during a recession. With a flood of new drivers chasing fewer riders, that safety net could fall apart. In Los Angeles, I'm David Wagner.
If you're planning to travel out of Los Angeles International Airport over the next couple of months, beware of construction. Starting this past Sunday, the passenger drop-off lanes in front of Terminals 5 and 6 will be closed. The reason? The airport's demolishing the upper departures level canopy between the two terminals. Passengers can still be dropped off in the area as long as it's to the east or west of the construction. The closures affect travelers flying out of Terminal 5 on American, Frontier, JetBlue, and Spirit, among other airlines. And then on Terminal 6, Air Canada and Alaska. So, flyer beware. The lane closures are for those terminals, will end November 14th. California's Mission era is part of the state's history that many are not too proud of. In a nutshell, Spain set up missions to convert Native Americans to Catholicism. Colonizing North America's West Coast was the point. But along the way, critics say the oppression of Native people was just another form of slavery that wiped away thriving cultures. Coming up, though, evidence that at least one group of Native Americans were able to not only keep their identity, but add the best parts of the new ideas they were exposed to going forward. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. If you travel 400 miles up Interstate 5, just an hour outside of San Francisco, you'll come across Tom's Point, a coastal ridge overlooking Tomales Bay. It was once home to a village for the Coast Miwok, a native population that lived in the area in the late 1700s. It's now an archaeological evidence site that could alter the timeline of California indigenous peoples. Sim Schneider is an assistant professor of anthropology at UC Santa Cruz who's been researching this. He's on the line now for more. Welcome to Take Two.
Hi.
So tell us, what got you looking into this archaeological evidence site in the first place?
Well, this is an archaeological site that's about 2 decades in the making in terms of my research. It's a place that has tremendous academic potential to help kind of rewrite the story of Native people that are responding to colonialism, particularly in the years after the missions in California. And this is also a place that is deeply personal to me. This is a project that also links into my own identity as a citizen of the Federated Indians of Great Rancheria.
So these are your people, the Coastal Miwok are your people?
These are some of my relations, yeah. Mm-hmm. And in the area of Tomales Bay and up towards Bodega Bay, these are communities of Coast Miwok-speaking people that throughout the mission time period from the late 1700s into the 1830s managed to stay put. They sometimes found refuge in these areas of western Marin County and western Sonoma County. And then during the time period after the 1830s, when the mission secularized, Native people are still living here or they're returning to these places because they still matter to them. These are their homelands.
Because I'll be honest, Sim, one of the things I think a lot of people think is that once the missions got here, it pretty much wiped out Native American life in California as we know it.
That's one of the narratives that we're trying to upend, and this is one of the places where we can really start to think critically about narratives of imprisonment, narratives of cultural destruction and extinction. My own community of Coast Miwok people were written off by anthropologists in the 1970s as culturally extinct. So this was an opportunity to really spotlight a place where Native people were still living, still practicing their traditions and livelihoods, but also engaging in this new economy that's taking off in California after the missions shut their doors.
So tell us what evidence there exists that they weren't wiped out, weren't written off when it comes to them still being a thriving civilization.
Well, we can put on our archaeology caps and, you know, look at the radiocarbon evidence that shows dates that are sort of hovering around a particular time period, the early to middle 19th century. So archaeological evidence includes radiocarbon dates. We have information that's coming from particular kinds of technologies like stone tool technologies, certain projectile point types that are reflective of a period of time just before the missions, but also technology that people adapt to introduced materials like bottle glass. So Native people are making tools from introduced materials like glass, but they're applying their pre-contact lithic technologies to those materials.
So there was clear evidence then that their traditions in this case were not completely wiped out, that these things continued.
Correct. They're still correcting. They're still collecting shellfish. Shellfish is a big part of the indigenous diet for this area. They're still fishing. So, you know, going out in boat or just casting lines offshore. They're still diving for abalone, but they're also incorporating pork into their diet. You know, all of the introduced foods that come with Euro-American colonization. They're also collecting seeds. They're managing landscapes. We can tell this from the archaeological record as well, based on little burned seeds that my graduate student helped analyze for me.
So which would be more true, Sim, that the California mission period did not affect these particular Native people as much as maybe others, or were they able just to integrate it a lot more successfully?
That's a great question. I think it's a little bit of both. This is a case study. This is one example, perhaps of many, of Native people that found a way to resist the missions by staying put in their homelands. And this is probably a story that you could probably see reflected in Native communities up and down the coast of California. And it's also a commentary on the missions. The missions weren't these walled fortresses. They were not these totally confining spaces of indigenous destruction. These are places that were dynamic. Native people lived at them. They continued to eat Native foods and create tools in their traditional ways. And they also, either through their own means or by allowances that were afforded by the missionaries, they were allowed to leave the missions and reengage with the landscapes. And oftentimes these are opportunities to hunt and gather, to hold dances, to bury your loved ones, and to hold other kinds of rituals that are deeply valuable to your identity and culture.
Talking to Sim Schneider. He's an assistant professor of anthropology at UC Santa Cruz. What do you think this says about the Coast Miwok people, especially during this time? I mean, it's just an amazing thing that they wouldn't have gotten completely culturally overrun.
It tells me that there's the story of resilience is, embedded in the fabric of our the cultures that we see around us, that these are legacies of people that are making do with dire circumstances, but they're also exercising the creativity that's necessary to survive a very dark period of time in California. So it casts a very positive light on my community, I think, and I'm fortunate to have their support in this endeavor.
Wondering if you've been able to share your findings with Coast Miwok people and what their reaction has been to it.
Oh, absolutely. I think there's a value in really talking about this particular moment in time in a very different perspective, one that really highlights the continuities, but also the changes that Native people did often on their own choosing.
Sim, do you think based on your findings that there are other Native populations in California that maybe had the same kind of success of maintaining their cultural identity? I would hope that the Miwok were not the only ones.
Oh, absolutely not, particularly with the missions. They were porous places on the landscape from San Diego to Sonoma County. I think what we need to do is really step back and reflect on the fact that we have, over 100 federally recognized tribes in the state of California in the 21st century, and there are equal number of federally unrecognized tribes in California. Hop across the border onto the Baja Peninsula, and you include that in the conversation, you have another batch of indigenous reserves that are alive and well in the present day. And I think that very fact of seeing communities around and alive in the present really casts a very different light on colonialism.
Yeah, because I mentioned earlier, Sim, how I think for most people that is part of California's dark history, the part that we don't like to talk about, but we know exists when it comes to what happened here. Why is this a big deal moving forward? What do you hope this discovery shares about how we remember Native people's history in California?
The story for me, and I'm just speaking as one person, one tribal member of Great Rancheria, but also one, Native Californian and, thousands that are out there. I think the story for me here is to really talk about a more positive story of persistence. This is a period of time at Tom's Point in the 1840s, 1850s, that's really preceding an era of genocide in California, one of the darkest chapters in California Indian history. But I think what often gets left us out of the telling of this story of destruction and annihilation of Native peoples is the very fact that we're still here and around in the present day. The missions came, the Russian mercantile colony, Colony Ross came and went, the ranchos came and went, all of these different American settler economies, they're still here. But I think the more important story to say is that Native people are still here. And throughout that long history of colonization that extends into the present day, Native people are still figuring out ways to protect their cultures and identities.
Sim Schneider is an assistant professor of anthropology at UC Santa Cruz. Sim, thank you very much for the time.
Hey, thank you very much.
All right, how would you all feel if the name of this show was changed to appeal to Spanish speakers? So instead of Take Two, it'll be called Tomar Dos en 89.3 KPCC. I mean, why not? Politicians, candidates do it all the time, try to sprinkle a little Spanish salsa on their mensajes. But if the Español is only that, words with no action, then is it still smart or just plain old hispandering? Find out when Tomar Dos continúa en 60 segundos. No se vayan. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Later this week, Democratic presidential candidates will debate again, this time in Houston. The broadcast will be co-hosted by Spanish language network Univision and translated in real time so viewers can hear the debate in English or in Spanish as it's happening. Candidates speaking Spanish has bubbled up along the campaign trail several times, but it's unclear if it's welcomed by Latino voters or simply seen as pandering. Here to weigh in, we have Luis DeCipio. He's a professor of political science and Latino studies at the University of California at Irvine. Professor, welcome back to Take Two.
Thanks very much, Jay.
All right. A long history of presidential candidates attempting to reach out to Latino or Hispanic voters by speaking Spanish. We're going to have a clip here of First Lady Jackie Kennedy from the 1960 presidential campaign for her husband, then Senator John F. Kennedy.
Queridos amigos, les habla la esposa del senador John F. Kennedy, candidato a la presidencia de los Estados Unidos. En estos tiempos de tanto peligro.
All right, that was almost 60 years ago, but have the motivations for appealing to Latino voters changed over the years? And how was it then compared to now?
Well, I think there's a higher expectation now. For one thing, you have Latino candidates running for president, and Secretary Castro is certainly expected to speak a little bit of Spanish, even though he wasn't raised in a Spanish-speaking household. But you also have candidates who have lived in Latino communities or have studied Spanish in school who sprinkle some Spanish into their stump speeches, and I think Latino audiences appreciate that effort.
Appreciate it, or how about maybe some saying, okay, really?
Well, there has to be follow-up with substantive commitments to Latino communities. So just speaking Spanish isn't enough. If President Trump started speaking Spanish, I don't think it would help him with the Latino community. But if you can get somebody's attention with a few words of Spanish and then have a substantive message about education or about immigration reform, I think Latino communities will listen to that.
Has speaking Spanish worked for presidential candidates in the past?
It has worked sometimes, but there have been some significant misfires also. It is important, if you try to speak Spanish, to speak it relatively well. I think it's also important if you adopt Latino or the connections to Latino communities that you do it well. So the classic example, of course, is when President Ford was trying to win Mexican-American votes in the 1976 race and ate a tamale, husk and all. That didn't go over very well.
No, it didn't. I remember George W. Bush staked his campaign on Latino issues. He spoke in Spanish often.
Absolutely. And there, I think, is a good case where a candidate matched the use of Spanish to messages that were trying to reach Latino communities. So his idea of a more inclusive campaign than Republicans that had preceded him. So there, the Spanish was part of a broader strategy and not simply throwing in a few words of Spanish.
Is it one of those things, Luis, where we are judging solely the candidates that have no Spanish in their background at all? No Latino in their background, no Spanish, no Mexico, no nothing in their background at all. That's the ones that we're really, really keeping an ear out for.
I suspect that's the case, and it's an unfair standard then for Latino candidates who are expected to be able to speak Spanish. But certainly if a Mayor Buttigieg coming out of northern Indiana is able to sprinkle a few words of Spanish or a few sentences in his case, I think he gets some extra attention. But again, the words have to be followed by policies that speak to Latino issues.
Now, demographically, the country's a lot different now than it was back in the days of JFK. Latinos on track to be the largest racial or ethnic group eligible to vote in 2020. Luis, how essential is it for today's candidates to get that Latino support?
In the general election, any Democrat who doesn't win Latino votes will not win the presidency. It is central to the Democratic strategy to win in the Electoral College and to win the presidency. Unfortunately, the primaries are a little bit different because the early states don't have significant Latino populations, Latino voices. So consequently, you can probably get pretty far along in winning the Democratic nomination without winning too many Latino votes.
Now, we've mentioned before Castro, Booker, also Beto O'Rourke. They've all spoken some Spanish over the past few months. And at different points, they wavered in pronunciations and grammar, too. Some of their websites also have wavered in that aspect as well. That has led some critics to accuse them of Hispandering. Can you explain what that term is suggesting?
That's the notion of pandering to Hispanic communities through the lowest common denominator, in this case, language. And to be honest, if we look back at ethnic campaigns in the past when candidates at the turn of the previous century were trying to win Greek votes or Italian votes, they'd throw in a few words of Greek or Italian. So that's always been there. But that's why if you want to avoid the Hispandering label, you need not just the words, but also the policies that Latino communities care about.
Are candidates darned if they do and darned if they don't at this point. I mean, it's like we're going to be so harsh on him on this stuff.
I think so, ultimately, because what Latino communities care about in November of 2020 or in major elections is that candidates are speaking to their concerns. And certainly somebody that speaks no Spanish will be able to articulate a message to win Latino votes against President Trump, I think.
Talking to Professor Luis DeCipio from UC Irvine, talking to us about the importance of Spanish in presidential campaigns. When it comes to age, do you think there's a generational divide with Latinos where some are more receptive to candidates speaking Spanish than maybe others?
Well, I think the divide is probably immigrant versus native, so naturalized citizen versus U.S. born. For the naturalized citizen who most likely was born in a in an environment where Spanish was the dominant language, that sort of cultural appreciation is greater. Where for the U.S. born, who tend to be more English dominant, there's probably the greater risk of being charged with the Hispandering.
Now, earlier this year, and I was mentioning how Spanish language websites of some Democratic presidential candidates appear to be not done as well as they could, just simple Google translations. Kamala Harris wrote in one aspect that she has spent her life defending American values, but she went with a direct translation from Google, which is gastado mi vida. That means wasting your life defending American values. Is this one of those things, Lewis, where you need to have someone that knows what they're doing to do this right?
Absolutely. For any successful Democratic candidate and even some Republican candidates, the key is having people on your staff, Latinos throughout the campaign. So some to look at the website, but also Latinos doing some of your outreach, Latinos doing some of your fundraising, so that the voices of Latino communities, and notice I'm using the plural intentionally, infuse all parts of your campaign. Bill Clinton did this very, very well in 1996, and he was rewarded with a really high share of the Latino vote.
And that's because Latinos are not all the same. You can go all the way down to the tip of Argentina, all the way up to Mexico. A lot of times, they don't see eye to eye on some of the same issues, yet some candidates seem to treat Latinos as some kind of monolith. I mean, that's also part of the problem, isn't it?
Absolutely. Mayor de Blasio has already faced that in the 2020 race, where he went to a Cuban-American community in South Florida and talked about Cuban Revolution. That wasn't a message that went over very well in that community. So, yeah, you have to be very sensitive to what parts of the Latino community you're speaking to and ensure that you're not picking an issue that alienates some Latinos. Certainly there are issues that unite Latino communities and candidates can focus on those, but, you know, again, the pandering, you have to be careful when you speak to a specific need that it actually is the need of the community you're speaking to.
All right. The million-dollar question, Lewis, is candidates, how can they do a better job of reaching Latinos? I know a bunch of industries that also have that same question for you.
They have to speak to the concerns of Latino communities, so focusing on education, focusing on economic opportunity, focusing on immigration reform. They have to have campaigns that are infused with Latino advisors so that they don't make stupid mistakes. And they have to ensure that they have connections to local Latino communities, so endorsements from local elected officials or local community leaders can be critically important. So it's bringing it all together and not just doing one piece of it. That's using a few words of Spanish.
That's Professor Luis DeCipio from UC Irvine telling us about the importance of Spanish in presidential campaigns. Professor, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, eh?
If you missed any part of Take Two today, whew, you missed a really good one. But there's a chance that you can hear it again. Just go to wherever you get your podcast, and there we will be smiling back at you, waiting to be heard. You can also find us on social media at Take Two. That's at Take Two. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.